This is the Seahawkers Podcast with Brandon Schultz and Adam Emmert, and today on the show we welcome on Jeff Baker. We welcome him back to the show, an investigative sports reporter and sports business columnist for the Seattle Times. He's been digging into the circumstances surrounding Frank Clark's arrest following the incident, and I think he's been able to get some good insight on both the incident itself and what happened afterward. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Anything I can do to help,
absolutely.
I'll try.
All right. Well, Jeff, Adam and I talked about the Frank Clark after the draft. So our listeners have a little bit of a background based on the information that was out there right after the draft pick was made. But just in the past couple weeks, it seems like there's been so much more conflicting information coming out, either coming from statements from witnesses, statements from others involved. And then an interview you had with the prosecutor in the case. Have you been able to get a clear picture of what happened based on all of what you've been hearing?
Well, it depends on who you listen to. The police report itself, not just the one that's been on the internet for 6 months, but the supplemental report, which we got access to last week, paints a very clear picture of what happened in the room. There's about five different people, including the victim herself, who says that she was punched. Either direct witnesses or indirect witnesses who heard other people saying she was punched at the time, and versus Frank Clark, who says he never touched his girlfriend. And then he subsequently had the girlfriend say that she fell into an end table. So I was asked to look into it because that's what we do. That's what I do. And when we look into it, we're not always nice. We don't go up and knock on doors and say, excuse me, please, can you please tell us the answer? I mean, we go at it about as aggressively as your average NFL lineman is going to pass rush a quarterback. And we get answers. We shake a lot of trees, and we're still waiting for some answers, and we're not going to stop until we get full answers from people as to what happened. What we do know is that sometime around the NFL combine, representatives of the Seahawks let Frank Clark's defense team know that they weren't going to draft him if he still had this domestic violence charge hanging over him. 2 months later, the prosecutor cuts him a deal, the domestic violence charge goes away, and he pleads guilty. I mean, and this is an important thing. He wasn't exonerated. He wasn't acquitted. He still pled guilty, but to a lesser charge in the case that removes the domestic violence thing from his record, and thus the Seahawks go ahead and draft him. That's as far as the criminal side of the case goes. We're still trying very hard to find out the reasoning, the rationale behind the decision to lower the charges, because I've had a lot of people suggest this is a he said, she said kind of deal, and nothing could be further from the truth. The people saying that haven't read up on the case and don't know what they're talking about. This is a case where you have about five different witnesses supporting one version of events that he hit her, and then you have one witness, Frank Clark, and then the girlfriend after she changes her initial statement saying that he didn't hit her. So it's not a he said, she said kind of thing. It's more like a five-on-one situation the way it was presented to the prosecutor. Now, if the prosecutor wants to go ahead and change that, which is totally, that's her discretion. She's got the prosecutorial discretion to do that. She wants to go and change it. We're going to ask why that happened. And so far, the only answers we've gotten is that it's based on confidential conversations with two people, with the victim and with the accused. And, take myself out of this, take anybody else's opinion in Seattle out of it for a second. You talk to any victims' advocates, you talk to any experts on the domestic violence, they'll tell you the two worst people to get that the correct version of events from is going to be the accused and the victim, because a lot of times victims will change their mind. And in this case, it appears from reading the statements that the victim did change her mind and offer a counter viewpoint, which is great. And if the prosecutor wants to go ahead and say that, that's fine. But she's got to explain why she did that, because you also have these other witnesses who are in the room saying something totally different. You have other people arriving on the scene within seconds, saying the kids ran out of the room screaming something totally different. You have a hotel night clerk saying something she was told by Frank Clark, something totally different. And yet none of those people were ever interviewed by the prosecutor. So we're trying to, focus the investigation around multiple things. Number one, what happened in the room? Number two, what this prosecutor actually based her opinion on. And we've demanded documents to back that up, documentation from her. We're still waiting to hear about some of it. And you know, we're also checking in with the Seahawks, because the Seahawks made some very, very firm statements in the last 2 or 3 years, and last fall as well, during the Ray Rice controversy, about how they're not going to take players who put their hands on women. And we want to look and see how in-depth their investigation actually went, as far as, you know, backing, as far as supporting that those very strong contentions that they made. Did they look into this with any degree of seriousness? Who else did they talk to besides Frank Clark and counselors who may have been working for him? That's what we've tried to ascertain. Because, you know, we don't just want people to say anything in this city and not verify whether or not they can back it up. It's called accountability. And that's, you know, that's what I get paid to do. So yeah, that's what we're doing.
And Jeff, I want to go back a little bit, because you wrote the story about the hotel night clerk. And what were some of the circumstances around her and her story?
She was one of the first people on the scene. She was up there within a minute or two. She had been patrolling the hallway on her usual night rounds. And then she got a call, because the two women that had run in and pounded on Frank Clark's door to stop whatever altercation was going on, had phoned down immediately. So she got relayed via the radio, what, walkie talkies, whatever they use. So she ran over to the room, and she went inside the room. She says she saw the victim on the floor. She thought she was initially intoxicated because she was so incoherent, and it turns out she did a breath test. She hadn't had any alcohol that night. The police report says the victim was very hazy. In talking with police, she said she had to lie down because she felt hazy. So that's exactly what the night clerk reported. And so the night clerk stood inside the room with Frank Clark, with the girlfriend. I believe there might have been one other person, one or two other people in the room. And she was waiting for the police to arrive. And there was also apparently a maintenance worker that came up and was waiting in the hallway outside, as well as a maid who had taken the small kids down to the front desk so that they could wait for the police to arrive. And so everybody's waiting for the police to arrive, and she wants Frank Clark to stay in the room. And she apparently said something to that effect. And then Frank Clark is alleged to have told her to basically shut her mouth, and that if she speaks again, he's going to hit her the way he hit his girlfriend. And that's what she says that she said. And so everything goes on that night. I mean, it's 11 o'clock at night. I think it was 1 o'clock in the morning by the time she got everything straightened away and left. And what she says is she didn't initially tell that to police that night, but police did not take a formal statement from her that night. They just spoke to her, and she relayed what happened, what she saw when she came in the room, what she did with the children, this, that, and the other. And the police also did not take official statements from the two women next door that night, but they all gave their official statements the next afternoon via email. And it was during it was after this night clerk had gone home at 1:30 in the morning, slept on it, woke up, and gave her statement the next day that she first mentioned this to police. The first thing the police did was call her right back and ask if she wanted to press criminal charges for threats and for assault, because he had apparently body checked her out of the way, or elbow checked her, I can't remember what, shoulder checked her out of the way. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, you know, she wasn't hurt. What she told me is she didn't really need that kind of hassle, going forward. And she said, you just want to make sure the kids were okay and everybody else. So she didn't pursue charges. And so the police let that drop, because they're not allowed to pursue that unless it's a domestic violence assault. Then they could pursue it without a victim's help. But if there's an assault, there has to be a complainant. So they dropped it at that point. But the police told me they included that in the overall package of the file against Frank Clark, just so that the prosecutor would have a well-rounded view of what went on that night, just so that she would have the complete picture of everything that people were saying and what was said, even though they couldn't follow up on an investigation. They left that in the file. And from what we've been told by everybody, the prosecutor never followed up on that angle. And so that's what we're a little concerned about, and that's what we're trying to get answers to. You know, I didn't just fall out of a turnip truck and start covering these stories. I've been covering legal affairs. I used to run the legal affairs bureau for the Montreal Gazette back in the early 90s. I mean, I've covered over 200 trials. I've spoken with my share of prosecutors, and I know they have a wide discretion when it comes to these cases, but, and there's a big but, they also are accountable for explaining their decisions. And like I said, this isn't a he said, she said, where there's only two people in the room and nobody knows what happens. You had multiple witnesses both inside the room at the time of the event and within seconds of it happening, who say that they heard things that were very prejudicial towards the accused, and yet this wasn't followed up on directly as far as interviews go by the prosecutor. And that's what we want to find out. We want to know, like, why, if you're going to come to a conclusion that goes against what everybody else is saying, including the victim initially, you know, what are you basing that on? And, you know, it's a little easy just to say, oh, I'm basing it on confidential conversations with the victim and the accused. Well, doesn't quite work that way. You have to have some kind of documentation just to show what processes you went through to back this up. And if you're going to say you didn't feel you needed to interview any other witnesses, you got to explain why. And so we're asking for these answers, and it's perfectly within any citizen of the United States has the right to ask these questions. A prosecutor is not God. A prosecutor, even a Supreme Court justice, isn't God. You know, all these people are human. They all have to answer for the decisions that they make.
Well, Jeff, we hear all sorts of stuff regarding this case. And one of the things that's been confusing to me and you just brought up is there was actually other people in the room during the time of the incident. That was something that I guess I wasn't aware of. I thought there were people that had heard from the rooms next door. And then, like you said, the maids and then the hotel clerk. So there were actually people in the room with Frank Clark and his girlfriend at the time of this. And the prosecutor did not question this person.
Yes, and we're finding out more and more as this goes on. I mean, part of the problem, and, you know, there's been an uproar from some segments, mostly from Seahawks fans who are upset, but there's been a few people, you know, questioning whether we're trying to retry the case and this, that, and the other. And I can assure you, we're not trying to retry the case. We're trying to look at how this case was actually, first of all, it wasn't tried to begin with. And second of all, we're looking at what went into the deal that the prosecutor cut with the defense team. And, you know, one of the most glaring holes in this whole story comes from an initial look at the file. I mean, this is what I do. I do investigative stuff. You know, one of the first things you're going to do in an investigation, whether anybody's doing it, is you're going to get the full accounting of what happened that night. And, you know, we did that to the best of our abilities. We got the police report. I mean, the police report was there online for anybody who wanted to look. But we also know that the first police report that comes out isn't always the last one that comes out. And we knew that there had been statements made by witnesses given to police the next day, and those weren't included in the initial report. So we asked for the full report, and there's an extra 15 pages that nobody apparently in this country had requested prior to last week when we requested it from the Perkins Township police force. And they submitted it to us last Friday. We got it Friday morning, and first thing you see is all these other things that we weren't quite sure about from the initial police report. Turns out there was an extra person in the room that night. We had always heard about a 15-year-old brother who said he saw something, and we'd heard about, and we knew there was another brother in the room or another child in the room of about five, and we assumed he was the other person who had said he'd seen Frank Clark hitting their sister. But it wasn't a five-year-old. There was a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old in the room that night that we hadn't heard about the 12-year-old until we got this supplemental report. And both the 15-year-old brother of Diamond Hurt, the girlfriend, and the 12-year-old brother both told police that she was getting punched. And neither of those two has been questioned by the prosecutor. The prosecutor says she tried to interview the 15-year-old, who's now 16, but he couldn't make it that day. And as far as we know, she never followed up on it. So she never talked to him. So that's two people in the room. She never talked to the 12-year-old. There's two people in the room she never talked to. Then there were the kids that ran out of the room, at least two of them, who one witness in her statement to police right outside the door said, ran out screaming that Frank's hitting our sister, Frank's hitting our sister. And then they also said Frank's killing our sister, which obviously he didn't do. But the first things out of their mouth, running out of the room in a terrified state, were Frank's hitting our sister. So there's two more that were inside the room saying that thing. Then you have the statement, obviously, which caught our eye from the night clerk, saying that Frank Clark said he's going to hit her like he hit his girlfriend. So that's five people. Right now, either directly or indirectly, who have heard from people inside the room that night saying that they were hit, and including the girlfriend. The girlfriend initially gave a statement to police saying she was punched in the face and fell back into the lamp. Later on, that changed, and we saw in the supplemental report how that changed to she fell into a nightstand. So this is what we want to know. This is what we have problems with. It's not just, you know, Frank Clark and his girlfriend weren't the only two people in the room. And initially, you had about five different people, or three to five different people, all saying the same thing, and Frank Clark saying something else. And somehow that's now changed to the prosecutor believes she never got hit, and which I'm perfectly willing to believe. And you know, it's quite possible that's actually what happened, but it goes a little beyond credibility it's hard for us to imagine why she wouldn't want to talk to any of the other people saying something completely different. You know, maybe they all saw something they thought they saw and they made a mistake. Maybe all five people or all four people or three people or whoever you want to think saw something. Maybe they all made the same mistake, but you got to at least talk to them to find out. You can't just take the word of the accused and the victim, according to any expert in domestic violence, they're the least reliable people in these situations. And in this case, you actually had extra witnesses. So this is why we're looking into this a little more closely. There are all kinds of inconsistencies in what's being told. The police are not happy with the way the investigation was handled. That much is obvious. And they've said as much and widely quoted to that effect. And so, you know, we're taking that into consideration as well. I mean, they did a very thorough report. I've seen police reports, and this wasn't he said, she said. This was a report with various witnesses all pointing towards one general conclusion. And then you have a prosecutor who comes out and makes very strong statements in the complete opposite direction without talking to those other people. And, you know, if I can say one more thing, we've had a lot of people, you know, write into the paper and say, you know, why should you believe this night clerk? She waited 24 hours to give her statement. She didn't tell the Times about it in the first interview. You know what? Those are all perfectly valid questions. And I think those are great questions for those readers to be asking us. And we'd like to know the same thing from the prosecutor. You know, like, they're very good questions. Why didn't you go and ask the hotel clerk those questions? You know, if you maybe the hotel clerk's, you know, somebody who's not to be trusted. Maybe she made it up, but you have no way of knowing unless you go talk to her. And nobody ever tried to talk to her to find out why she waited.
So the Seahawks' conclusion lines up with the prosecutor's conclusion, but neither of those two spoke to one another. Have you spoke to any witnesses or anyone involved with the case that would suggest that the Seahawks' conclusion and the prosecutor's conclusion, that they're getting information from similar places?
I think that they are getting from similar places. I believe the Seahawks talked to counselors who talked to Frank Clark, and counselors who might have talked to Frank Clark's girlfriend, third parties who weren't in the room that night, who came upon afterwards to do whatever evaluation they were doing with them. And that's who they spoke to. I know the prosecutor, I believe the prosecutor spoke to those people as well. I'm told the Seahawks never spoke to the prosecutor, told the Seahawks never spoke to the police. The Seahawks did not get the supplemental 15 pages of the police report that we have, from what I've been told. I was told by the police that they never requested anything. And you know, that part for me is another thing I would ask. I mean, again, I don't pretend to be the best investigator on the planet or better than FBI investigators or anything like that. But one of the basic rules of any investigation involving the police is you go out and you get the documents that were collected that night. You get a full read of the scene. And then after that, once you have a full read of the scene, you start trying to get a hold of the people who are actually there. And we try getting hold of the people who are in the room. We tried approaching the 16-year-old, mm-hmm. who is now 16, who was in the room that night. We tried approaching Diamond Hurt, a male who answered the phone, hung up. We approached Diamond Hurt's mother, who was not in the room. She was downstairs, but presumably they've had conversations. She wouldn't comment. And then we got a hold of the people who had nothing to do with the family, the two women next door, and we got a hold of them right away. Their phone numbers were included in the police report. You didn't have to be an expert investigator to track them down. We could have, but it was very easy. We found them in 5 minutes because their private numbers were right in the police report. And so, you know, you look at all that, and then we were able to get the hotel clerk as well. It took us a day or two. And Chris Daniels from King 5 was able to find her. I mean, this isn't brain surgery we're doing here. This is basic investigative work that if you're actually trying to find out what happened in an event, you're going to do. It's called covering all your bases. Now, I don't have the subpoena power of a prosecutor. And if I did, you better believe we'd be talking to a lot more people than we're talking to now. But, you know, for the people who think we're being a little too aggressive and stuff like that, hey, I mean, all I'm going to say is, I'll tell you what, this isn't a game that's played on a field. We're not talking about some football game. I played football in college. I know what the football life is like. I've lived it. I know what, I know what goes into that mentality. I've lived it. I grew up. I got over it. This is real life we're talking about here. This is a serious crime he was accused of. And we're not going at this like it's a game that we're playing. We're not playing a game. We're going at this for real. We're going to find out answers. And you know what? If we have to shake a few trees and ruffle a few feathers, that's what's going to happen. And if people don't like it, tough luck.
Well,
that's all I can say to them.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that I've found interesting about all this is that in this era of infotainment, where a lot of the news organizations almost turned into just almost cheerleaders for their local squads for the most part, I've really been impressed with the way that the Seattle media, specifically you guys, have gone after this and have really investigated deeply into this to try to find out the truth. Because that's the job of a stinking journalist at the end of the day. Do you guys ever worry, or how do you balance the idea that you guys are doing something that's kind of hard hitting about the Seahawks and then still hoping to not cut off your ties with them so that you're able to still have those kind of connections with the team to cover the team on a daily basis? How do you guys kind of balance those decisions?
That's a good question. It's a really good question. And my honest answer, and I'm not trying to be glib, is I just don't worry about it. I covered the Seattle Mariners for 6 years. I covered almost seven years. I covered the Toronto Blue Jays for almost 9 years prior to that. And believe me, I wrote my share of controversial stories. And if we want to even get into men against women, we wrote about Josh Lucchi and his situation. We basically pointed a finger right at the general manager and almost accused him of flat out of lying about that, about knowing about Josh Lucchi's past. You know, we did that. And I didn't lose sleep worrying about it. And, you know, just went about my job the next day. And the truth is, most of the players, I never heard one word from a player on the Mariners who had any problem with anything I wrote about Josh Lucchi. And to be fair, Jack Cerensik has never said one word to me about Josh Lucchi and anything to do with that. And I covered Jack Cerensik for two or three more years after that and had many interactions with him. I actually was chatting with him at a party not too long ago, believe it or not. And we were both at the same house party together. I mean, we've had our history. I just don't worry about it. What I worry about is what I'm doing with my job, and whether or not I'm being fair to all people involved. I mean, look, you know, to the people writing in hate mail and stuff like that who are saying I'm hurting the local football team. I mean, the thing I worry about most is am I going after Frank Clark in a way that's unfair? Am I looking at his case in a way that's unfair? And I don't think that I am, quite frankly. And that's why even when I'm talking to you right now, I'm not offering my strict opinion as to what went on in that room. I'm telling you what the facts of the case say and what the explanations of the case have been so far and how they don't jive with what the facts are in the police report. I mean, that much is there. Anybody can draw that conclusion. And so it's really tough to do that and try to keep that line. Some people will say you're being biased because you're not giving the whole story. You're not telling about his hard upbringing in South LA. I couldn't care less where he grew up in South LA, to be honest with you. That's not, that has nothing to do with the case of whether he beat up his girlfriend in a hotel room or not. So, you know, people who are saying you have to balance it out with that stuff, that's ridiculous. You don't have to do that. And so as far as it comes to dealing with teams afterwards, you know what, there's 40 whatever guys in that room. And you know, I respect our beat writers who have to go in there every day and still do. Fortunately, I don't have to do this anymore the way I used to with the Mariners. But I mean, I did this with the Mariners too. I'd have to go in the room the next day and try to get post game quotes out of everybody and the usual stuff that you have to do when you're covering a baseball beat. And I did it. And most of the time, the people who worry about this stuff, it's mostly the fear that gets to you more than anything. The reality is never as bad as the fear. Most of the players, you know, honestly, don't harbor a grudge about this kind of stuff. Most of the players from the Mariners couldn't stand Josh Lucchi, and neither could their wives. That was the truth. And the reason he's had a hard time sticking in baseball ever since, he's got a stigma attached to him everywhere he goes in baseball. And players aren't that dumb. They can see through some of this stuff. I don't think our beat writers are going to have that much of a problem. They might have issues over minor stuff. But in the end, you know what? We're covering the Seahawks. If the Seahawks don't want us to help give them free publicity in the paper, that's their problem. You know, I mean, it's, I don't worry about this kind of stuff. They're a private business. We can always cut back on the coverage of them, give it to somebody else. You know, if we run like 4 pages of Seahawks coverage instead of 6, is anybody really going to notice? People are going to stop buying papers? I don't think so. I think newspaper guys worry way too much about this stuff, and they should be more worried about their jobs and the criticisms that media are now corporate mouthpiece all over America, not only in sports, but everywhere else. That's the kind of stuff I worry about. You know, all I can tell people is this is not a vendetta against the Seahawks. This is a quest to find out whether or not the words that they spoke so strongly last fall actually meant anything. We're trying to figure out whether they practice what they preach. And if they don't, you know, they could just come out and say so. But if they're going to say, you know, we did a thorough investigation, well, we're going to look and see how thorough their investigation actually was. And we're going to look and see how thorough the investigation the prosecutor did actually was. That's what we're going to do. And we're going to do it until we get the answers. We're not going to stop. So, and we're not going to be nice about it either. We've been nice to this point. We're very polite when we first come up to people, but we're not going to sit around for months waiting to be stonewalled by people. We're going to ask questions that make people uncomfortable. And, you know, if they're uncomfortable, it's tough.
Well, Jeff, I really want to thank you for coming on the show. I definitely appreciate the fact that you've shared kind of some of the heat that you've taken, because anyone who's read the comment section on any of those stories can see some of the blowback that you've been getting.
Yeah, it's been a little extreme.
A little bit.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. If I could interrupt for a second, I will say that, we expect those kinds of comments. I mean, they'll happen. It's not just a Seattle thing. That happens all over the country, no matter how crazy the story. You go back and look at when Milton Bradley was assaulting his wife back when he was playing for the Mariners, and people were starting to write about the case a little. Go back and look at the comments on those and how we should leave him alone and this kind of thing. I mean, it happens, and it's just not here. You go look at the Jameis Winston case in Florida. You look at the newspaper comments. That's why we don't take them seriously. I mean, and I'm really saying this to be truthful with you guys. They are the last things that we're ever going to listen to in something like this, because they're the least credible sources of information that we would ever get ideas from. So we're not going to read the comments and say, oh, you know, Joe Blow, Seattle fan, thinks that we're doing a bad deal. Nobody cares what they think. We have gotten a lot of letters of support from people, emails privately. We've gotten a lot of private messages. We've even gotten some tips from prosecutors about what we should be looking for. And, you know, so as far as that goes, the blowback part of it, I can tell you, I can count on one hand the number of subscriptions that have probably been canceled as a result of this, and I guarantee you they'll all be signed up again next week, because that's what happens when people cool off and they realize they missed their morning paper. They usually go and sign right back up again. So that has had absolutely not one iota of impact on anything that we do. And I'm not saying that to be defensive. I'm saying it to tell you the truth. That's the last thing that's ever going to push us off a story like this.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Jeff. And once again, I really thank you for bringing some of your insight just behind what you've been looking into as far as this case goes. And we'll look for your work in the Seattle Times in the future.
Please do. I appreciate it, guys.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.